well. So thank you to everyone who puts in such an amazing effort into the service. We continue on that. Now, let's see if this works. Yes, it works. Fantastic. We're continuing on in this series, Next Steps. And isn't that ironic that, you know, we're talking about apology and Steve apologized. So that's fantastic. Opening illustration right there. But last week, we had just a brilliant sermon from Shell about forgiveness. And what we are going to, I guess, talk about this morning is what's on the other side of that. Our text last week from was from Matthew, but Luke has a version of that in Luke 17, verse 4. And in Luke's account, the whole question that Peter's asking Jesus is, Jesus' answer to Peter, I should say, is if your brother or sister comes to you and repents, forgive them 70 times 7. In other words, if your brother or sister comes to you and owns up to what they did wrong, forgive them 70 times 7, etc. And so on. So in other words, there is an implication that yes, forgiveness is important. Absolutely. We stand by absolutely everything that was spoken about last week. But what happens when I'm the perpetrator? What happens when I'm on the other side of that reconciliation process? Because forgiveness is just one part, a major part, absolutely, of a whole reconciliation process. So we're going to talk about the other part of that reconciliation process. Is it relevant? Maybe the best way to understand whether it's relevant or not. Show of hands. Who has ever been hurt by someone else? Should be quite a few hands up. Here's the really prickly one. Who's hurt someone else? We're a very honest church. That's good to see. We as relationships happen, we bump into each other. We bounce off each other. Things go wrong. So I did a bit of research because I like my research. Saying sorry in the 21st century. Well, I listen to a lot of podcasts. One of the podcasts I listen to is the Carrie Newhoff Leadership Podcast. Now, why is that relevant? That is one of the biggest single Christian-based leadership podcasts there is. Millions of people listen to that. There's millions of downloads. It's one of the big ones. So I thought, well, if there's something on apology, surely Kerry Nuoff would have interviewed a guest on that. Now, it's a great podcast. I don't want to knock on this podcast, but I did some searching because the great thing about this podcast is they do full text transcripts. So you can just put words in the search bar and you'll get different episodes. So I put the search word teams. I put in the search bar teams and I got 50 episodes pop up. Now that's about 70 hours of content. I typed in the word preaching. Do you know how many episodes came up that talk about preaching? 70 episodes. That's about 100 hours of content. It's long form podcasting. Most of the episodes are an hour and a half. But then I typed in words like apology, sorry, apologize. Would anyone like to guess how many episodes turned up in the search bar? Jared's right. I got a freshly baked glazed donut. Absolutely nothing. And I'm thinking, you got to be joking. This is one of the leading Christian church leadership podcasts in the world, and no one is talking about apology. I find it staggering because we live in a crisis of trust. When asked about leading, particularly new generations, Mark McCrindle, some of you may have heard of McCrindle Research. He's one of the, obviously, heads of that. He's part of the McCrindle family. He said in 2019, we've seen over the last few years people pushing back on institutions in all their forms. I don't know that people ever did trust an institution. It's that they have, however, lost trust in leaders of those institutions. It's a leadership crisis, not a crisis of structure or institution. And it does come back, therefore, to trust, to authenticity. He goes on to say that basically people have been burned And not only that, but when people have been burned in context of institutions, that is many people, it's sort of a bit like, well, can't you just get over it? Who would rather no apology at all than a fake apology? I know I would. And we can, so we can celebrate internationally, churches, we can celebrate with other voices like Justin Briley that talks about how hardline atheism is on the wane, at least in Great Britain. Gen Z, Gen Alpha, they're more spiritually curious than their parents, but have you noticed churches aren't all of a sudden overflowing? Why? Well, I think it's because we may well be living in a spiritually curious age, but it is unfortunately also a relationally skeptical one. People don't want to be burned, especially young people. They don't want to be burned. People have been burned, not just by individuals, but by communities that have done wrong. But not only just done wrong, but then gone on to deny it, or even worse, admitted it, and then followed up with a can't you just get over it? We live in a corporate age. What do I mean by that? It's an age where apology is merely often an element of a management strategy that William Benoit calls image repair, image management. Who watches Gruen on ABC? Anyone watch that? I love that show. It's fascinating, isn't it? I sent out during the week an email about what happened to Apple recently, how they did a real misstep in their advertising campaign, and they had to do a public apology. But it all falls under this idea of image repair, repairing the public persona. But friends, what I want to say this morning is that there is nothing image, there is nothing surface about true biblical apology. Because the great hope and the great concept, I guess, is that biblical apology is not about repairing an image. It's about the repairing of hearts. It's about the repairing of hearts. So how do we do that? How do we do this? Number one, we make it a priority. Let me read you something. Matthew chapter 5, verse 23 to 24 says, "Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to them, and then come and offer your gift." You know, it's interesting to me that often Jesus will say things that actually a lot of other people are agreeing with, in a sense. There are at least three extra biblical major Jewish sources that talk about the importance of being fully reconciled before offering any kind of gift or worship. One of the most important of those is Ben Sira, as I wrestle with my microphone this morning. It's been annoying. But notice a couple of things. First of all, Jesus sets this realization in the midst of, not beforehand, in the midst of the solemn practice of worship, the solemn practice of offering a gift in a holy space at the temple. This is a practice that is not to be interrupted. To leave the gift at the altar and run out of the temple would be at best awkward and at worst a disgrace. You could imagine, like, you know, if someone just all of a sudden just runs out of church. Did you see? Oh, I can't believe what was going on. You know, the gossips afterwards would be like, what's... It would be a shameful thing in Jewish culture, not least because it automatically straight away reveals that that person has not followed the teaching of the rabbis and made sure that they were prepared beforehand in the first place. In other words, that person who's running out is willing not to repair their image, but to sacrifice their image. They're willing to wear the shame, the cultural shame, of interrupting this solemn practice of leaving their gift and to just run out. And it's not, secondly, it's not the realization that you have got something against them, of course. It's that someone may have something against you. Someone may have reason to hold a grudge against you. True apologies, they don't get tied up in knots. This is first priority stuff. They don't get tied up in knots stopping to give culturally sensitive and appropriate explanations as to why you got to run out of the temple. True apologies push past cultural shame and image management, because true apologies flow from a concern for true righteousness and real people. And I want to just pause for a second here and put a little asterisk on this. Notice also that it is the person in the midst of their individual worship that has realized something's wrong, I need to be reconciled. There may be someone here, because it does happen, who has been compelled by one or many to apologize for someone. That is toxic. That is scapegoating. So if you are sitting there going, oh man, people have been telling, it's one thing to say, hey, have you thought about, or how are you going with this person? And it's a whole other thing to say to someone, you should go and apologize to this person. It's a tricky topic that we're moving through this morning, because in all of this, we're talking about making it a first priority, but unfortunately, there are some people in this world, they're called narcissists, who will use this as a tool of manipulation, who will utilize these things to sow false guilt. Don't put up with that. If you have someone who always seems to be telling others to apologize, or he always expects an apology, but you've never seen them apologize to anyone else, there's a clue. Sorry for that pause, but it's just really important to get right. I've been in situations where I have been literally scapegoated, and it is awful, and it is extremely hard to resist. So we are talking about the realization of, oh my goodness, I am not reconciled with a person in a normal, healthy, functioning relationship, not a toxic one. So what's going on in this space? It's the considering of our own condition. We consider our own condition. You know, some might say, but Jesus never, in that text you just read out, he never talks about admitting anything. He's only just talking about reconciliation in a general sense. Okay, cool, fine. I would say to that, okay, fine, but maybe we should look at what Jesus says about reconciliation. So what does Jesus say about reconciliation? Here's a famous text. Why do you look, Matthew 7, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother or sister's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother or sister, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's the plank in your own? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from the other. Ken Sandy wrote an entire book by the name of The Peacemaker. It's a whole book on reconciliation. And the first phase of the peacemaking strategy that he lays out is get the log out. That's what it's called. Reconciliation, it's about understanding our own faults. It's about really having a think about, where have I gone wrong? What assumptions have I made? And what we're saying this morning is it's within this process that apologizing is the act of crucifying our own self-righteousness. It's the act of owning our own stuff. But you know what? It's one step even further than that, a distinctly spiritual step, and that is this. The process of apologizing, I don't know if you've noticed this, the process of giving a sincere apology also highlights where we are allowing the enemy to take ground in our lives. And by enemy, I'm not talking about the other person. I'm talking about Satan. This is one sentence that changed my life in Sandy's book. He says this: Satan prefers that we do not recognize his role in our conflicts. It's not just you and the other person. There is another team on the park. We have an active and evil enemy that is seeking to sow discord and conflict among us. We need to be aware of that. And when I have had to apologize to people and I've gone and done the sort of, okay, I need to think through, how have I really crossed the line here? It has been so instructive before the Lord as I've sat there in the space of prayer where God has all of a sudden revealed to me, I'm allowing evil to start to seep in and get a foothold in these spaces. One of the favorite things of Satan that we do is just assume. Often Satan loves our assumptions. And so Jesus is not asking a rhetorical question when he says, why do you focus on the speck rather than your own plank? I think he actually means to say, think about why we do that. Self-examination, it's a spiritual act. But why do we tend to look at the specks in others and ignore our own faults? In other words, why is apology so hard? The problem is that sometimes to really grapple with our faults, it's hard to imagine that God would still love us. That's why apologizing can be terrifying. Leaning into an apology awakens us to reality. The true reality of things. You know, there was a guy in the Bible that grappled with this when he really realized how he had gone wrong. And he was in that space of repentance. He realized there may be consequences. There may be consequences. Real apology, this is the next thing. We have to make sure we're ready to accept any consequences. He said this, this is David, have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion. Blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions and my sin is always before me. Have you ever been in that space where you know things aren't right with another person? You know you've done something wrong and you're trying to ignore it, but it haunts you. It's there in the back of your mind. And then David says something interesting. Against you and you only have I sinned. What does he mean by that? We'll come back to that. And done what is evil in your sight. So you are right in your verdict and justified when you judge. Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. David does not offer any excuse. He does not minimize anything that he has done. But he also recognizes something deep in his soul. And that is, if God is the creator of all, including all of those around him, then any sin, every sin is ultimately a sin against the creator. A sin against a child of God is a sin against God who created them. It is God who's keeping score. And more likely, in light of God's holiness, he is defenseless. One of some of the most confronting words in all of Scripture. You are right in whatever you decide concerning me, O God. whatever you decide to do. What's David doing? He is saying to God, free shot. I'm not going to try and put anything in front of me. I deserve whatever is coming my way. I will own any consequences, any judgment. But he's saying that as a complete and utter wager upon the mercy of God. He allows himself to fall completely into the mercy of God. What's the point? The point is this: biblical apology is unreserved apology. And this is why we hate it when we get a fake apology. How annoying is it when, you know, a CEO has run a company into the ground? There's a few of those happening at the moment, isn't there, in the building space. And we see this thing where, like, you know, flash, 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 the cameras are on and there's a press conference or whatever, or a press release indeed, this is image management, is made. And then there's all these things, but yeah, we apologize to the stakeholders or the families or whatever the nature of the company may be. And then later on, you're scrolling through Facebook a couple of days later, or you open the newspaper and they've received a $30 million payout. And our indignation rises because it's like, what? There's people that have gone broke, people that are struggling, and then this person gets a golden handshake. Are they really taking on the consequences? No, it's fake. We all hate that. But let's not repeat it. If we have done something wrong, we can't apologize with like a little asterisk of expectation, it's all going to be fine now. They may not be able to forgive you straight away. That's okay. You can't expect things back from the victim. But the final blocker: unreserved apologies, they come from humility. See, Paul addresses, we've looked at the corporate example, but Paul addresses the extreme opposite in Romans 6. He says this: this is to people who have apparently repented and accepted God's forgiveness. But look at how they're living. He says to them, he says, what shall we say then? Because obviously someone's been saying it in this church. This is to the church in Rome. Shall we go on sinning that grace may increase? So some people are going, it's all good. The love of God. We just go on sinning. That's fine. Surely if we're more sin, the more grace, right? By no means, says Paul. Paul is apoplectic at this point, by the way. We are those who have died to sin. How can we live in it any longer? How could you, he says. He says, how can you possibly understand the gravity of what Jesus has done and go on minimizing your own sin? It's all good. But the other question that's implied in this is, why would you do that? Why would you do that? What leads us into this unbelievably toxic dynamic to just kind of go, Lord, you know, I know I'm a sinner, but your grace, it's all good. It's it. I know you got this, in a casual way. You know what we're doing when we're trying to minimize our own sin? We're hiding. Behind every lack of apology, false apology, or refusal to own our own stuff, there is this. When the cool of the evening breeze was blowing, the man and his wife heard the Lord God walking about in the garden. So they hid. They hid from God. And this is after the fall, of course, after they had eaten the fruit about which they were commanded not to eat. What used to happen, by the way, in the cool of the evening? They used to go for walks with God. They would stroll with him. There would be communion, friendship, relationship, community, a depth of community that we just can't even imagine until we get to heaven. And so there is God walking out. Time for our evening walk. But they hid. And then the Lord God called to the man, "Where are you?" There's a question that echoes down through the ages. Where are you? So often people say, "Where is God?" What if God is saying, "Where are you? Where are you?" And the man replies, "I heard you walking." The very thing that used to signify connection and communion with God. "I heard you walking in the garden, so I hid." Hiding from God. But then there's this next bit. "I was afraid." Why was he afraid? "Because I was naked." Terrified of exposure. That's why we minimize our own stuff. We're terrified of exposure. That is the culture we live in. Image management. How could I possibly be fully loved if people really knew the real me? That's what's behind it all. That's what's behind a struggle, ultimately, to apologize. But friends, I want to give you an invitation this morning. As our band makes their way up onto the platform, we've got some folks on home teams that just in a second, they're going to supply some pens for you. Did you notice there's bits of paper on the seats this morning? Have you been thinking, what's this all about? Well, now you're going to find out. Here is the call this morning. Because of what Jesus has done, we don't have to hide anymore. And maybe there is a person that, you know that you've been avoiding, and like they kind of know that you know that they know that you've been avoiding. Maybe there's something that's unreconciled or a relationship unreconciled in your life. It takes connection with God to say, you know what, I'm going to go first. I'm going to say I'm sorry for my part. Whether you want to reciprocate or not, I'm going to own my part. You see, Jesus invites us to fall into the hands of his forgiving mercy. He invites you and me to think of not only that person we need to forgive, like we did last week. You've had your rock with you for the whole week. But also the person we know that we've wronged. Because he calls us to freedom. Freedom from our need to be right. Freedom from personal harm minimization strategies. Freedom from our own excuses. Freedom from image management. Freedom to apologize to another person without expectations or strings attached. And I promise you, there are few things that are more filling than when we follow Jesus in this space. I remember some years ago, I had cause to apologize to a staff member. And it was so hard. And when I knew I really had to, I start doing the thing where it's like, I'll start a text message. No, I'll write an email. No. I realized I had to go and see them face to face. But I walked away from that meeting. I felt so much lighter. She was so merciful to me at the time. In the mercy she showed me, I felt the mercy of God. So there's a piece of paper. I've got a piece of paper in my pocket, and there's a name on it. I know who that name is. God knows who that name is. You don't. But maybe there's a name that you might think of as we worship in just a sec. What I want you to do is, if there's a name, just write it down on that piece of paper so that you can take that piece of paper home. And my challenge to you this week is this. Not text or email. If there is a name that comes to mind, that you need to make something right with a person, to go first and say, hey, I just want to say, I'm really sorry. Ring them up or meet for coffee and take a step of freedom. Take a step of freedom. So let's stand and let's sing together. And if you think of a name, call for a pen.